person for me. And it's a pleasure to be able to give this talk. It's not the kind of talk I've ever given before, so it's nice to be able to give it in front of good friends and where I feel comfortable. So I'm going to try and keep it really short, and so that there's plenty of time for discussion and questions. I really want to hear what you have to say. So the reason for giving this talk is to get your thoughts on it. Yes, thank you. Sorry about that. Good. So let's get started. So Einstein sketched out his epistemology of science in various places in his writings. He never gave a fully comprehensive account of it, but one of the key indications of the way he thought about science and the progress of science, he laid out in a letter to his lifelong friend Maurice Olivine. He wrote it in 1952, towards the end of his life, so it's really representative of mature thinking on science and epistemology. So in that letter, he drew this diagram, which is, so let me just say what the diagram is. So the diagram itself appears in the letter, and A is labeled system of axioms. And then there are these lines that go to S, S prime, S double primed, and they are labeled as resultant propositions that are deduced from the system of axioms via some logical rules of inference. And together, Einstein didn't do this, but I'm going to refer to this as T theory. So in T, one has concepts and axioms related to those concepts, and then these logical rules of inference. And you deduce these propositions logically, precisely, definitely from the axioms. And then there is also E. And in the diagram, Einstein draws E as a rather bold and definite straight line like this. And that is the variety of immediate sense experiences. Between T, the theory, and E, there are these rather tentative kind of arrows, a couple of which are just dotted arrows. And this one, I don't think this means anything, but one's solid and the other two are kind of dashed lines. And then there's a sort of rather delicate kind of arrow that starts in this region between the theory and this variety of sense experiences, and it goes up to the axiom. Okay, I'm not going to say much about that arrow, but this structure is going to be relevant to this talk. That there's this theory, and then there's this variety of sense experiences, and then there are these arrows between them. And, all right, here's a quiz. Okay, so I'll ask at the end of the talk. Question. What is missing from this diagram? That one might expect to see. Ask at the end. All right, so another place that Einstein sketched out his epistemology of science is in his autobiographical notes, and that's included in a volume called Einstein, Philosopher, Scientist. And here are some quotations from both the letter to Solovine and to the autobiographical notes. So he says, "I see on the one side the totality of sense experiences, on the other side the totality of the concepts and propositions that are laid down in books. The ease, the immediate experiences are given to us, Just a comment here. I don't think Einstein means to deny that the experiences are shaped by the theory. So if you just consider your experience being a stop sign, that's not some kind of uninterpreted experience. I mean, it's shaped by theory. So, okay, so just a caveat there. The concepts and propositions acquire meaning and content, respectively, only through their relation to sense experience. The connection of the latter experiences with the former, the propositions, is purely intuitive, not itself of a logical nature. The degree of certainty with which this relation or intuitive connection can be made, and nothing else, is what differentiates empty fantasy from scientific truth. What this boils down to is the eternally problematic connection between the world of ideas, T, and that which can be experienced, E. This talk will discuss this connection between the world of ideas and that which is experienced. So, it's going to be intuitive, non-logical, and problematic. Suppose there's a theory of consciousness, of what people call neural correlates of consciousness, or there's a common acronym which is NCC, so that stands for neural correlates or neural correlate of consciousness, that says such and such an event in A's brain, let's call it E-neur. I should have chosen a better. It's difficult to say, isn't it? This thing, E-neur. So some event in a subject's brain correlates with the subject having so-and-so conscious experience. Okay, suppose there is such a theory. We have such a theory. Consider this so-called argument from knowledge. And it appears in many different forms in different places, but this particular one is due to someone, philosopher of mind called Jackson. If the subject A grows up in a locked up in a black and white room and learns everything there is to know about the NCC theory, so communicates with the outside world via video channel and it's all black and white books, black and white papers, and she knows absolutely everything. She knows exactly what neural correlate of consciousness in her brain corresponds to, for example, seeing colours. When she steps outside the room and experiences colours for the first time, she gains new knowledge about the world. And that knowledge is what it is like to experience colours. And that's not something that she can have learnt from the NCC theory. So there's something about experience, which is the what-it-likeness of experience, that cannot be encoded in any NCC theory. That's the conclusion, that there's something missing from any such theory of neural correlates of consciousness. Finding what's missing is what people call solving the hard problem of consciousness. It's hard because, according to this argument, anything at all that one might add to the NCC theory of the same sort, like such and such event in the brain, no matter what it is, does not teach the subject A what it's like to experience colours. If she's locked in a black and white room, she does not know what it's like to experience colours. And the hard problem also looks hard by the light of Einstein's epistemology, because what is an NCC theory? It lives here in T. So you have to lay down in the theory concepts of sense experiences. And I think my interpretation of the term qualia is that that's an attempt to do that. It's an attempt to create within the theory a concept which is sense experience. And then, having done that, having created the theory with these concepts of sense experience, you have to make connections between the experience concepts in T and the actual experiences in E.
with some degree of certainty, otherwise your theory is just empty fantasy. And that's obviously, you can see immediately that there's a huge danger that you've got some kind of circularity going on. You've got set concepts of sense experience in T, and you have actual sense experiences in E, and you're supposed to make some kind of connection between them with some certainty. So it's, you're skirting on the edge of paradox and circularity here.
So can I ask something? If you go back to the previous slide. So why does this have to be true? I mean, are you that the first bullet point you have, is that an assumption or is that taken as fact? Or yeah, so I'm just wondering why this is so obvious or is it not?
You'll have to ask the people who make this argument. I'm just giving you what
you think. What this is what Jackson has said. That's what, yes, you're just quoting Jackson.
Yes.
Okay.
And many others. So the people. So. Thinkers who accept that there is a hard problem of consciousness use this argument as it, to justify their position that there's something missing from any NCC theory. So David Chalmers is the main proponent. I mean, he coined this term, hard problem of consciousness. This is one of the arguments.
One idea is to say there is no hard problem. That's just false. That there's.
Yes, there are people who argue so.
If you don't think that that's the first point, it's true, you're not making the argument. You just need some aspect of mental sensation which has no explanation to NCC. It's not color, it's not smell, it's the wrong.
I think that I would accept that, yes. Okay. So, making a slight break, let me quote to you these statements made by Arthur Eddington in his public lectures in Edinburgh, I think in 1927. I think it was published a year or two later. You can read them online, and I read them a long time ago, and the lectures contain his famous statement about the second law of thermodynamics, which if you don't know, I won't tell you, but it's very entertaining. Okay, so, but I'd forgotten about this chapter, and I'm grateful to Hugh Price, the philosopher Hugh Price, for drawing my attention to this, to these comments during a discussion about the paper that I've written. So Eddington says in chapter 5, which is on becoming, well, that's the title of the chapter. Unless we have been altogether misreading the significance of the world outside us by interpreting it in terms of evolution and progress instead of a static extension, we must regard the feeling of becoming as, in some respects at least, a true mental insight into the physical condition which determines it. And then again, but if there's any experience in which this mystery of mental recognition can be interpreted as insight rather than image building, it should be the experience of becoming. And finally, the view here advocated is tantamount to an admission that consciousness looking out through a private door can learn by direct insight an underlying character of the world which physical measurements do not betray. So the idea here, so here's an idea, the experience of becoming that Eddington is referring to, the perception of the passage of time, is the aspect of conscious experience to which the hard problem pertains. That and only that. And then to solve the hard problem, we need to find a physical correlate of this perception. So not a particular perception of color, not a particular perception. So it's nothing to do with the content of one's experience, but it's to do with the quality of one's experience. Okay. So, indeed, this idea has been proposed by Raphael Sorkin that there is a physical correlate to our perception of the passage of time. And this is what Raphael says in his paper, relativity theory does not imply that the future already exists, a counterexample. So Raphael says, it, which is the example of the sequential growth models for sets, even provides an objective correlate of our subjective perception of time passing in the unceasing cascade of birth events that build up the causal set by accretion, as it were. I'll say a bit more about this later on. And I'm going to reframe it for the purpose of this talk in the following form. So I'm going to call this the heuristic. The process of the partially ordered birth or births of the atomic events that compose E-neur, which is this neural correlate of consciousness event in the brain, in causal set theory correlates with the subject A having the corresponding conscious experience in real time. In other words, what is missing from the NCC theory is the birth process. I could just actually end the talk here, let you muse on this idea, and we can have a discussion. But I'm going to expand on it a little. I'm going to remind you a bit about causal sets, and then I'm going to list a bunch of connections, these dotted lines, between properties of the process and reported qualities of conscious experience. Throughout, I'm going to assume a classical view in which space-time is a single causal set. And these connections that I'm going to make, they're woven from two threads. The first thread is process, concept, process. And the second thread is partial order. So I'll take those in turn. So process and the concept of events. And I'll use the example of the random walk. Probably the simplest possible stochastic process. So there are two ways to conceive of a random walk on the integers, say, let's just for definiteness say it's a random walk on the integers. A, as a dynamic process, where the walker at each stage steps to the left or steps to the right with a particular transition probability. And B, a static measure theory. So in A, there's an actual process. These steps take place. And the theory is defined by these transition probabilities. B, you consider all possible completed histories of the walker. So they're infinite sequences of integers in a big bag, and let's call that bag omega. An event is, so this is a technical term that's used in stochastic processes, a measurable subset of this omega. So it's a bunch of histories. In the bag, all possible histories. For example, the event the walker is at 5, position 5, at stage 13. That's the set of all of these infinite sequences of integers, such that at the time 13, at stage 13, the integer is 5. The 13th integer in the sequence is the number 5. That's an event. It's something that can happen or not, because it's a stochastic process. It may or may not happen. Whether it happens or not is contingent. And it corresponds to a set of histories. All the histories in which that thing is true, that at position 13 in the sequence, the number is 5, all of those together are the event. B is a stochastic process in name only. You choose one completed block universe, in other words, one completed infinite sequence of integers, at random from the bag, once and for all. That history is the world. And each event, such as this one, either has occurred or has not occurred in that world. So you take out one history, it's an infinite sequence of integers, you check and you see whether the 13th one in the sequence is 5. If it is, then you say the event has occurred. If it isn't, you say the event has not occurred. Okay. Mathematics favors B because theorems, prove lots of theorems, and math loves B. Mathematicians love theorems. But A and B, I claim, and this is absolutely crucial to my talk, to my argument, that they are different
physically. So as physicists and not mathematicians, there is a difference. It's a choice whether you model your world as A or as B. In A, there is the process of stepping and a physical order in which the steps occur. That's a physical, it's a physical thing, the stepping. And also in A, there's a difference between an event such as this, which is just some subset, it's just some statement about what where the walker is at a particular time. There's a difference between an event and its occurrence. So its occurrence is the actual process of the walker stepping between wherever it was and 5 at stage 13. This again, it's crucial to my argument that there is such a difference. If you deny this difference, then my argument does not hold.
Is there a test that could distinguish?
Yeah, can you leave these questions? So those are very broad questions, not questions of clarification. Thanks. When I want to emphasize this difference between an event and its occurrence, I'm going to refer to the event as an event as such. Okay, in B, there's no stepping. There is no occurring. You just pull out one infinite sequence of integers and events have either happened or they haven't happened for all in a timeless way. All right. In both of these cases, there is an external picture. So there's an external picture of the dynamic process because you can just conceive of a movie, right? I film a movie of numbers appearing in sequence one after the other. And that's an external picture because I can share that with you. So I can create this movie of this process going on and I can give it to you and you can understand it and comprehend it and we can share it between us. So it's communicable. It's an external picture. In B, the external picture is static. It's just, you can write it down on a piece of paper. You can write the event down on a piece of paper. I can write it down, static thing. I can give it to you, you can give it to me. So this concept of event in physics, I've chosen random walk as the example of something that might happen, which is just a set of histories. This exists also in deterministic theories, such as general relativity, because uncertainty about initial or external conditions mean there's also contingency for events in such theories. You don't know for sure whether an event is going to happen or not. Whether it does or it doesn't depends on things like initial and external conditions. So the concept of event is, it's part of the mathematics, the structure of stochastic processes for sure, where it's very common, that's what you see all the time, for event algebras with measurable events. So, but this concept is more general. So it occurs, it's there in deterministic theories such as classical mechanics. So, Raphael proposed that the birth of space-time atoms in causal set theory can be a physical correlate of our conscious experience of time passing.
This is a clarification question. Just, are those two really describing the same thing? Because in A, you have, you know, at least the chance that is included somehow in the description of the path being different. But in B, there's no space for such a possibility at all, right? Like you choose only one path that actually happened. So it seems more limited in some sense.
So that's a very good point. I mean, it's part of Niyash's question, whether these really are distinct, A and B. And that's a part of our discussion that I'm hoping that we're going to have, right?
Clarification question. So for the case B, do you also like have that, let's say, position in time t equals to 12 would be either 4 or 6 or could be any? Because in the case of A, you're just moving to a neighbor position, right? Time goes by. Like that's what we're expecting from a random walk. But then for B, it was not clear to me if you're actually just moving to a neighbor position, so it could be like gamma of 12 could be anything.
Okay, so for definiteness, let's say that the walker only steps one step to the left or one step to the right at each stage. But nothing that I've said here will depend on that.
So like, but for case A, this was clear to me, but for case B, it's not clear. So
that's just a restriction on the kinds of infinite sequences of integers that you'll allow in your bag. You could allow the ones that have zero probability, but they just have zero probability, or you could exclude them from your bag. There are two things you can do for B, for the picture B. Okay. So I'm going to give you three slides on causal set quantum gravity. So it's based on three pillars, or grounded on three basic concepts. The first is that space-time is physically discrete. And if you like, you can consider it as it follows from a repudiation of physical infinity. The second pillar is that order is a more primitive organizing principle for physics, even than space and time. The space-time causal order, I've put that in inverted commas, of all the continuum space-time structure, it's space-time causal order that survives in the deep theory. And I've put causal in inverted commas here because what I mean by it is the term causal brings all sorts of baggage with it, which I want to not touch on. And so what I mean for this talk by causal order is just precedence order, before and after. And then, this is a bit obscure. I left it in from a previous talk, but precedence order and discreteness are a marriage made in heaven. I can explain that maybe at a different time. But here's an example of a discrete order. So it's a very tiny one, five elements. And the order relation is just denoted by these arrows that has a direction. So D precedes A precedes B. It's transitive, so D precedes B. That's just an example of a very tiny discrete order causal set. And the third pillar is that the path integral furnishes a framework for quantum theory, which is a genuine alternative. It doesn't include by the canonical psi framework. The quantum mechanics in this path integral framework is a species conceived of as a species of measure theory, in which the Kolmogorov sum rule fails and is replaced by a quantum sum rule. And many of you here at PI know about it because this quantum sum rule was the subject of experimentation at IQC, famously, by Urbashi.
It can be just partial order, right?
Yes, that's absolutely crucial. So
you don't need C and B to be related.
Absolutely. So the precedence order in the continuum in GR is a partial order. And the causal set that underlies it is also a partial. Thank you.
Okay.
So the idea is that a discrete order is like a synonym for causal set. Its elements correspond to space-time atoms. They're indivisible, smallest events. And the idea is that a causal set made of roughly 10 to the 240 elements can be the discrete underpinning of our observable universe. This number is just is derived from the Planck scale. This is the full volume of the observable universe in Planck units. The idea is that a causal set that's obviously vastly bigger than this, with all its causal with all its order relations, can be approximated by a continuum Lorentzian space-time. And the slogan that goes along with causal set theory is order plus number equals geometry. Skip over that. Okay, so we're going to assume that causal set theory can do the job in the sense we're going to assume that continuum space-time can be an approximation to an underlying causal set. And let's focus on this event, this neural correlate of consciousness event E nu, which is composed of two things, a space-time substrate with some matter degrees of freedom as decorations on that space-time substrate. In causal set theory, this piece of Minkowski space, so let's assume that the relevant neural correlates of consciousness in the brain, we can neglect any kind of curvature. So this will just be approximated by a piece of Minkowski space. It is a continuum approximation to a causal set, set of space-time atoms with some order of precedence, and there are about 10 to the 120 of them. And you consider that if this is a piece of the Minkowski space approximation for this, the space-time substrate in the brain, then here I've just picked out five examples of the space-time atoms of the underlying causal set. And the order of the space-time atoms is a partial order. The light cone structure of the approximating continuum is respected by the order of the underlying order of the space-time atoms. So O precedes R, R precedes S, P precedes Q, P precedes S, and that's it. Those are the only order relations. And there, so there are no others, so O and P are unrelated, P and R are unrelated. And for the matter degrees of freedom, we just suppose there are certain decorations on these space-time atoms. A space-time atom with its matter decoration is an atomic event. The occurrence of E-neur in causal set theory is, by analogy with the random walk example that I gave, it's the process of the birth, the coming into being of its space-time atom. And there are actually interesting models in which the steps of this process of the birth of these space-time atoms are given certain definite probabilities, like in the random walk. So which, as the causal set grows, it grows according to definite probabilistic rules, transition probabilities from one partial causal set to another partial causal set with one more space-time atom. And these are called, so they're due to David Rideout and Raphael Sorkin. No. So in this conception, they don't die. They remain. They're part of the past. So the past is growing. They don't die.
Question: Is the 120 related to 140? I don't understand.
No, the 120 is just you estimate the size of a neuron.
That's for a neuron.
Yes. Okay, so just to say this, repeat myself, the event E neur is not the same thing as the occurrence of the event. The birth of an atomic event is not the same thing as an atomic event, just like the birth of a baby is not a baby. So they're two different things. There's the space-time atoms, and there's the birth of the space-time atoms, and they are different, just like the birth of a baby is not a baby. But the birth process cannot be pictured as its objective, live, dynamical self from the outside. And this is a difference with the random walk. The random walk, I could give you a movie of the random walker. So it's actually stepping. There's the numbers are appearing one after the other, and I can give you a movie of that. We can talk about it externally from the process. But this birth process here cannot be so pictured from the outside because it's partially ordered. So if you try and imagine it, so if all these space-time atoms have to be born in the process dynamically, they have to be not there and then they're there, right? So they're born. So S has to be born. But before S can be born, P and R both have to be born because P and R precede S. So P has to be born and R has to be born. But there's no order for P and R. There's no physical order in which P and R are born. You can't picture the process because it's partially ordered. So one can have an external picture of the process if you add labels to these events. If I label 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I can imagine them being born in that order, in that sequential order. O is born, and then P is born, and then R is born, and then Q is born, and S is born. But the order in which I'm imagining that P and R are born in is not physical. That's pure gauge. In reality, Physically, they do not have an order. That cannot be imagined. So, the choice of labeling, which allows you to have this external picture, is not entirely physical, is not entirely objective. You cannot have an objective external view of this process. So the heuristic is that one can have an objective view of the process, but not an external one. You can have an objective view of the process if that view is from within the physical system. If you are part of the physics, if you're internal to it, then you can see it. And that internal view, compare that to Eddington's private door, that internal view is conscious experience. And here I just want to say that internal view and private door, they convey a sense of distance from the process that might be a bit misleading. Yet one is experiencing the process, but it's more than that. The heuristic says that one's experience is the process. It's not you're viewing it, but that conveys some sort of distance from it. You're viewing it. You're experiencing it. That it is experience. The process is experience. Okay, so qualities. So now we're getting to this. Here are some arrows. Yes? So
when you say one is experiencing it, do you mean, can it be a stone?
Good. So here's the heuristic again. The birth of the atomic events that compose this neural correlate of consciousness event, E-neur, in causal set theory correlates with the subject having that conscious experience live and in real time. So here are some connections. So in the birth process, each atomic event occurs once. The occurrence is momentary. Immediately it occurs, it becomes part of the past. So immediately it's born, it's now part of the past. And conscious experience has been described as momentary, fleeting, and of the now. The birth process is unceasing. Conscious experience of time passing has been described as inexorable. The birth process can only be objectively viewed from inside the world as it happens. Conscious experience has been described as live. The birth process can only be viewed from inside. The entity having the experience in the world cannot copy and communicate that experience, cannot share it with another entity, since to do so would be to create a picture of the process that's external and objective. If I can tell you exactly what this experience is so that I share it exactly with you, that's an external, picture that I can give to you, but that's denied by the birth process. Conscious experience has been described as internal and private. The birth process is objective. Conscious experience has been described as indubitable. Indubitable. If you want to read a very kind of muscular defense of the fact that conscious experience is objective, then there's a philosopher called Galen Strawson. Yes, entertaining to read what he writes. So he stresses this very strongly that it's the most facty fact that we have, right? If we're sure of anything, then we're sure that we're having experiences, okay? And then the birth process is the experiencing. There's nothing mediating. Conscious experience has been described as immediate, unmediated. Okay, so I'm going to end by saying, just giving a list of various hard problem issues in the light of the heuristic. So consciousness in the block. So in the block, the answer to the Wittgenstein to Anscombe type question, what would it, I'll explain why that, ask me later. What would it look like if it looked like, as if our world were a block universe is, it wouldn't look like anything because it would all be over. Nothing is happening, there's no experiencing. There's no experiences anymore. Something is missing, the NCC theory is a theory based on concepts of NCC events as such, and live experience is the occurrence of the events. And the something missing is the birth process, which is the occurrence of the event. The knowledge argument, anyone who knows the NCC theory knows the full physical account of the event as such, E, that corresponds to A, had a conscious experience of seeing a red ball, But one cannot know the physical correlate of A having the experience live and in real time, because the correlate of that is the partially ordered birth process, and only A can view it, experience it from within, live and as it happens. Panpsychism is, roughly speaking, the idea that everything is conscious, and the heuristic is sympathetic to it only to the extent that the birth process is universal to the whole physical world. The question which entities have conscious experiences, do rocks have conscious experiences, is the question which events are NCC events. And that defines the quest for the NCC theory. People work on it. For example, the supernova is an event composed of atomic events. The partially ordered birth of the atomic events composing the supernova event is the occurrence of the supernova event. It happens, and its happening is this process of these space-time atoms coming into being. Was the supernova that occurred conscious is a question that the NCC theory should answer. Fundamentalism about consciousness. The partially ordered birth process is fundamental and not emergent in causal set theory. The process cannot be recovered from something more basic. The NCC theory, on the other hand, will be constructed using concepts in biology, neuroscience, and cognitive science, such as neurons, information processing, fast model fitting, etc. So when people ask, is consciousness fundamental? The answer is yes and no. How does consciousness interact with physical stuff, particles, fields, etc.? Well, conscious experience, by the heuristic, is the birth process in the brain. So this question makes as much sense as, how does the birth of a baby interact with a baby? When I thought of this the other day, I had this sort of got the giggles and thought it was hilarious. So the process is the creation of the stuff, 4D space-time stuff. So asking how it interacts is not the right question. Doesn't make sense. All right, and finally, if we return to Einstein's epistemology, the partially ordered birth process and causal set theory, it blurs the boundary between the world of ideas, T, and this E, the variety of immediate sense experiences. It blurs the boundary between the world of ideas and the totality of sense experiences. The birth process in causal set theory, as its live, dynamic self, cannot be situated fully in the world of objective, communicable, physical concepts because the births are partially ordered. So it's a concept in the theory, but it can't live entirely in here. Though the process is a concept in theory, it can only be fully apprehended as its dynamic self in the manifold of sense experiences. It can only be objectively viewed from within. It has to be lived. It has to be experienced to be apprehended. One cannot know from the outside what it is like. And I'll end there. Thanks for listening.
Because we have plenty of time to discuss. So let's maybe start by student question. Thank you, Nicole. Definitely convinced that you can talk about causality in terms of this partially ordered relationship. But I'm having a struggle to understand how the dynamics of this birth process occurs. Like, would you have a conservation of the amount of events that you need, like these atomic events that you need from time slice to time slice? Like, how would that be? Because it'd be an estimate for a number, right? Is that the number at a given time slice? How would that work in a sense?
So the number is associated with space-time volume, and it's nothing to do with space at all. There's no concept of space fundamentally in causal set theory. So the events are like this. They're momentary. They don't form anything three-dimensional at all. So it's space-time volume, which is composed of these atomic events. So those numbers are, you take a four-dimensional space-time volume, and you ask how many Planck four volumes can you fit into it? And that's where those numbers come.
So you use the age of the universe, essentially.
Yes, that's right. So the age of the universe, it's a very handy way to remember the age of the universe. That's 10 to the 60 Planck times.
Thank you.
Yes.
So you came up with a number of 10 to the power 240 for the causal sets, and your explanation is that the four-dimensional Planck scale from the beginning of the universe. So the question is that what if the universe contracts in a way that even though time is going forward, it contracts more rapidly, does that mean that the causal sets are decreasing?
No, because it's the whole history. So long as more things happen, then there'll be more space-time volume. So it's the whole of the causal past of, let's say, us now. So it makes no difference whether the universe is expanding or contracting. The full volume of our past is increasing.
So the rate is decreasing, basically. The rate of causal events.
Yes, I think you could probably say that.
With the space-time diagrams and the causal sets, would the partial ordering come from the fact that simultaneity or the ordering would be reference frame dependent for an external observer?
Yes, the partial ordering comes because there is no physical concept of simultaneity. That's it. So from relativity of simultaneity to a more physical conception is the leap. So you say, yes, when we think about it in terms of a particular coordinate system, then there will be an ordering given by the time coordinate. But in GR, coordinates are not physical. There's no physical concept of simultaneity there, so they just have no order.
But so would the space-time events themselves be internal to the system and not have that partial ordering problem? Or
can you say that question again?
I think you made a distinction between like external observers or like being a part of the birth process. Would these space-time points be as part of the birth process and not have that problem?
Not have what problem?
Partial ordering, I guess. There's a problem everywhere.
So physically, they're partially ordered, and that means that one cannot view the process as it's happening from the outside. One can perhaps speculate about whether or not it's really the case that one cannot conceive of a process except in a linear order. But I'm claiming that one cannot, so I can't. Maybe other people can. Maybe on psychedelic drugs you can do it, but to conceive of, to make a model of the process as it's happening dynamically, to make a movie of it or even imagine it, I'm claiming that you have to imagine it in a linear order. You have to imagine this atom being born and then this one and then this one and then this one. But that linear order is not physical. So your imagining is, or your right, or your creation of the movie is, it's forced to be gauge dependent. You're forced to introduce a gauge which is subjective and non-physical. So you cannot have an objective physical conception of this process live as it's happening. So if you make a movie up, so Einstein says that all of this has to be able to be laid down a book. If we add to this conception that we are allowed to make movies, right, to add a more dynamical way of recording our, you know, writing about and thinking about our theories, that doesn't help in this case. It helps for the random walk. You can have an external view of the dynamical random walk because it is linearly ordered. But because this is partially ordered, even that is not enough. You include movies as well as books in here, that's still not enough. It's not flexible enough You still can't, you can't have an external view of the process because of the partial order. Because the partial order is physical. That's the physical precedence order.
Yeah, a follow-up on this question. So I could imagine a situation like this that is not the movie, but I could think of a book with many chapters which says at the start, you can read chapter one in whatever order you want, but then to read chapter three, you need to have read the other two first. So this would be like the equivalent of those two points that are not part of the order, but the next one is read.
Except that when you do read them, you will read them in an order.
Each person does read it. Of course, they do take a particular order, right?
Yep.
So when you say we cannot experience it, what you mean is we cannot project this on this movie setting, right? We cannot project it on this time ordering, this one-dimensional time ordering. Why is this a fundamental concept? Is it because in our experience we always experience things in sequence and we try to relate to this?
I'm claiming that, yeah.
Could you imagine beings that don't express things? I wouldn't want to deny consciousness.
You know, I think I agree. I agree. Maybe there are. But for those beings, I think they would be able to directly communicate their experiences to each other. That's what I think. So if we were able to capture the externally, you know, so from the outside, capture live this partially ordered birth process, conceive of it, or, you know, somehow record it, then if I gave it to you, you would be able to experience the thing. I mean, that... I'm conjecturing. I mean, as far as we know right now, you know, you can't experience what I'm experiencing. But if we were able to conceptualize, really, actually externally, and to the extent that we can communicate that with each other, I think we would be able to then communicate our experiences. And I'm not saying that's not possible. I'm just saying I think we're not capable of doing it. Maybe we can train ourselves to do it, but then, you know, that could be a total revolution. Then we could, you know, you could experience what I'm experiencing. I mean, you know, imagine the consequences of that, you know.
Thank you, Faye, for very inspiring, which you are putting so many things together. And one of the things that I found more refreshing was this idea that a lot of the nonsense that comes with the block universe can be resolved by realizing the fact that there is not external view of the block universe. We have only this view from the inside. So this is beautiful. But at the same time, there is something in the end of your talk that on which maybe I want your reaction at this point. That is the fact that, you were stressing also in this answer, the fact that between these different views, there is no communication and there is not the possibility to ask this question of what is like. And this is a problem that we found in different approaches, for instance, also in relational quantum mechanics. There is this question, how do I make sense of the fact that each observer experiences a different reality, experiences a different element of truth in the world? And the answer there, that is also an answer that is given more in general in a part of philosophy of science, is the fact that there is communication between views. So it seems to me that in the answer that you were giving to Lydia just a moment before, you were saying we are not able to communicate our complete truth, our complete history, our complete everything. But it seems to me that the point is not to communicate the whole, is that we share pieces. Also in this
histories. We share just pieces of stories. And these are elements for which we can communicate and we can agree and we can share. And these are ways in which different views can communicate, even though, of course, you're right, that the full story, the full individuality of each observer can never be dissolved.
I think I agree with everything you said.
So is there any way to use this framework to talk about the distance and space and time separation between events? Because general theory gives us, as well as the notion of causality, it also gives us this notion of physical distances and time, right, separation. Is there any way that I can use this framework to picture these things, or would I have to add something to it in order to be able to extract these things?
Yeah, very good question. Thank you. So it's a beautiful thing about causal sets is that you don't need to add anything, because what you're asking about is physical scale. So physical scale is given by the counting measure, and that you have that because the causal set is discrete. So in the continuum, you're absolutely right. You need to add extra information on top of the causal order, on top of the light cone structure. You need to add that extra physical information. You know that two conformally related metrics have the same light cones, right? So the light cone can't fix that degree of freedom, the local scale. But with causal sets, because it's discrete, you can just count. And we've already heard about these examples where you just count the number of elements in a particular space-time region. That is the space-time volume. So the scale is given by the discreteness because you can just count. And a nice example of that is time-like geodesic distance. So there's a concept of a geodesic between two elements in the causal set, which is a longest chain. So proper time maximizes is the a geodesic maximizes the proper time along any curve between two points. And so a longest chain is the analog of a time-like geodesic. And you just count the length of the chain. So how many causal set elements are there in the chain? And that's a measure of the proper time along the geodesic in Planckian units. So
instead of like Einstein's equations, as equations tell us how space-time behaves in presence of matter.
Mm.
So essentially, instead of this, you would have some sort of equation that would tell you how many atomic events would be created after a good event or in a region.
We would love to have such a thing, but we don't have a discrete version of the Einstein equations so far. So
that would be the idea. You're seeking something that would tell you how many atomic events would come up after.
We haven't tried something like that, but I'm not saying that it wouldn't work or you couldn't do it. But we've been concentrating on finding a quantum dynamics, essentially a path integral theory for causal sets. So we haven't put any effort into trying to recover classical dynamics for causal sets that is like the Einstein equations. But that would be, that would be fabulous if we could have such a thing.
Thank you.
More questions?
Okay. Let's see if I can get these out of me. So I think I have three questions. The first one is, the first part of the talk is sort of trying to, it's posing, I think, an epistemological question or something, how to relate the experience of reality or this distinction between the timeless totality and the experienced entity that flows. Okay, that's trying to address sort of the epistemological question, I presume. That is one of the goals of this endeavor, right? Explain this that Einstein was talking about. That would be the first question. I just want to have a clarity in mind of what's the goal of the intellectual endeavor, let's say. The second question would be, as following what Rick was asking is, you were mentioning not only partial order emerges, but then apparently also notions of distance and geodesics emerge. What other structures do there emerge? So you mentioned you're trying to use some quantum, study quantum mechanically. Well, I don't know, I wonder, does matter emerge in any way? Is it only... Okay, what other structures of the physics that we know could emerge from that or have emerged and would have been done? And third, is this, how is this related to, for instance, Wolfram's work, if there is any relationship whatsoever, if you have ever considered that? Those are the three questions.
Wow. I don't know what I don't know how to answer your first question, but I think I can safely say I'm never going to write another paper on consciousness again. This took me so, it was really a huge struggle. It started out as a kind of just a collection of aphorisms, you know, just sort of sayings, you know, slogans. And then I don't know, but I'm not going to be participating in it, I have to say. That's the question about the whole causal set quantum gravity program. So we don't matter. That's a real frontier of the unknown for us. We don't know how matter is going to emerge, matter as we know it, let's say, emerge from causal set theory. The one thing the most concrete thing that we have, or the most concrete hypothesis that we have, is that the whole of GR, the space-time, you know, the Lorentzian structure of space-time in GR, we hope will emerge from causal set theory. But I can tell you about specific things that we've done, but that's, you know, it's a huge. So that you might be interested. So I wrote a paper with Jeremy Butterfield. So if you just search for me and Jeremy, then we have a paper which kind of one of the chapters summarizes things that are known about causal sets.
Jeremy
Butterfield, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I have my Butterfield number is one. And then what was? Oh, yeah. Well, that's interesting. So Steve. I participated in some online discussion with Stephen Wolfram and some of his collaborators, which lasted for, I don't know, 3 hours or something. It was exhausting. But of course, I'm sympathetic to the idea that, so what they do is discrete, so that's a connection. What they do is very algorithmic, and I like that too. But they're not, you know, it's not a causal set that they're creating, some other sort of structure. There may be causal sets kind of in there, but there's much more structure to what their models are producing, and they're also deterministic. So they're not even stochastic. You know, they're not even classically stochastic. They really are deterministic. You know, it's like game of life determinism. So that. I struggle to see how they're going to incorporate quantum interference into their program, but yeah, there are certainly points where there's sympathy.
We have a question online. DJ, is you? I don't know. Yes, very good. Hi.
I have a clarification kind of question. On one of the slides, you mentioned the Wittgenstein to Anscombe type question. What would it feel like if we have a block universe? And your answer, if I remember correctly, is it feels like nothing. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I'm why?
So it's from the perspective of the heuristic. So there's enormous amounts of work. If I look at the screen, and you see me looking at you? No. Oh, okay. Right. So there's a huge amount of work done on how to reconcile the block universe perspective with our experiences, experience of time passing, all sorts of experiences. So that just exists. I mean, that is this, that people are trying to do the work that one needs to do to connect a block universe theory with our experiences. So people that's work that needs to be done, and people are trying to do it. But if you take the view of the heuristic, then there's a process. It's a physical process, and that process is real. It's, you know, real is, you know, it's a disputed word, but it's physical. It actually happens. It takes place. And if you have that perspective, then what is a block? A block is just what you get, what is created by the process when you run the process to the end, right? So the block is what you get from the perspective of the heuristic. The block is what is left behind, what's created, the space-time atoms all forming this four-dimensional space-time with descriptions of dinosaurs and human beings and, you know, living and dying, all that in there in the block. That block is the history of everything that happened, but there's nothing happening anymore. And since live experience is live, it's, you know, it's the occurrence of events. And in a block, there's nothing occurring. Nothing is happening anymore. It's just laid out. It's just, everything has already happened. So we're dead by then. So you're not experiencing anything because we're dead. The block is a dead thing. It's just, you know, it's gone. It's, you know, with the process, the universe is a going concern. But within the block, it's all over. Does that help?
Well, I'd be curious what Wittgenstein would reply to you.
So I called it... Good, okay. That question was not to do with the block. So that question was... There was a little episode that's related by the philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe. So she was, you know, Wittgenstein's, he was her mentor in some sense. So she wrote a little book called Introduction to Wittgenstein's Tractatus. And in it, she relates this incident. So she said, one day Wittgenstein greeted me with the question, why do people say that it was...
was the Earth going around the sun?
Yeah, that one. That's right. So why do people say that it was natural for people to think that the sun goes around the Earth? Right? So why? And she said, oh, well, I suppose it's because it looks as if the sun goes around the Earth. And then he says to her, well, what would it look like if it looked as if the Earth spins on its axis? So that's the question. So anyway, that's the question. What would it look like if your theory is the right theory? So what would it look like if? So that's that type of question. What would it? And I promised I would mention. So that question was asked to me by a friend, you know, a person well known to you all, Enrique Gomez. So he asked me that question, that very question. He said, what? Because I was railing against the block being a dead thing. And he said, well, what would it look like if the universe were a block? So
to carry on this analogy, in the sun case, the answer is they look the same. Either the sun goes around the Earth, looks this way, or the Earth rotates on its axis, looks the same. So in your context, maybe we have a processing universe that there's real growth of events. In the other case is we have a block universe. So the question is, you know, what do experience differ in these two cases? I guess one kind of answer could be they're the same. It doesn't make any difference.
So I think advocates of the block would claim that, and I claim that there is a difference. I claim there's no experience in the block, but there is experience when there's a process. So
my question is why? Why isn't there experience in the block universe?
Well, because it's all over.
And then, because Wittgenstein would reply, are you really saying anything? Are you asserting your answer? Are you really answering your question?
Okay. So the question is, is the heuristic useful? So it's true that at some level it looks the same if the sun goes around the Earth and if the Earth spins on its axis, at some level. But one of those perspectives we know better now, right? So one of those perspectives turned out to be scientifically useful, and the other perspective, has been consigned to the dustbin of history, right? So that two perspectives on the same kind of, even if they were empirically the same, which they weren't, but anyway, suppose they were, then one perspective can lead somewhere and the other perspective can be a dead end. And that's how, in some sense, you can only judge, the perspectives with hindsight. So once you've gone to the next stage, you can then look back and say, aha, that perspective led nowhere. This perspective was actually the one that we needed in order to make progress. And I claim that the heuristic is like that. It may be that I actually believe that we can argue until we're blue in the face about whether there's consciousness in the block or not. And it's sort of, it's a pantomime of an argument. You say, yes, there is, no, there isn't, yes, there is, no, there isn't. And it's deadlock. So only if a heuristic, non-logical, intuitive connection leads somewhere. So I didn't discuss this arrow, right? So there's the arrow. So how do we come up with the axioms? How do we come up with new physics? How do we come up with how do we make progress? This is a free creation, as Einstein liked to say. It's a free creation of the human mind. Right? How do we create it? What guides us? And it's this heuristic. The claim that I'm making is that this heuristic can help guide us towards a theory of quantum gravity.
Yes.
But I don't think I actually don't think we can settle the question now.
Okay.
Thanks for the question.
I agree. Certainly not now.
Okay.
Just, did you want to address the question you wrote at the bottom?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so what's missing from this diagram that you might expect to see in a diagram of epistemology of science?
Theory of neural causals.
So that will be in here. Yeah. Any theory is within in that bit.
The fact that maybe there are like human biases, in the sense that the way we experience things is partially determined by our human nature, and that we could have unconscious bias and unconscious bias right from the beginning.
That's possible, yeah. Of course, you can change. I mean, human nature isn't set in stone, so this in itself. It's something laid down in a block, in a book, right? This thing, literally, you can go and look at it in a book. But it's not. You can't lay it down in a book because it is in itself process. Scientific advances are, science is a process, not a set of, rigid things that you lay down. All right, so the thing that's missing, or at least the thing that my students point out, is the world, W, right? You might expect that in the epistemology of science diagram, you'd have W, the world, right? It's nowhere.
It's an idealistic account.
Einstein was everything, his epistemology it encompasses realism, it encompasses idealism, it encompasses everything. It's a very broad synthesis of many positions. That was a question.
Oh, I was just going to say, you said maybe the world is missing, but I don't know, maybe it's not supposed to, I mean, there's the whole point of the talk, it's not supposed to be there, but an objective reality. Is it, were you saying that the world is missing from the diagram, but it's not necessarily really missing? Maybe it shouldn't be there? Or is that not what you were saying?
Well, speaking personally, I think there is an objective world that exists out there independently of me. That's my perspective. But the question is, how do you access it? And I suppose Einstein is saying that the way we access it is via a theory.
Okay.
It's a
Thank you very much. I think we are a bit over time, so I will close the official session now. Let's thank Fei again for